SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping,
interviews.
This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Clocker's Corner, Santa Anita Park, Arcadia, California, a very good Tuesday. Race fans, Sirius 162, XM 207, Sports Zone 999, if you're listening to Sirius XM online, and at our website, stevebick.com. And, we'll certainly lift the mood soon enough, no sooner did we get off the air yesterday in New Orleans, and particularly because I had taken a photograph at 7:30 Central Time of maybe 25 horse fans lined up in the parking lot back up against Gentilly at Fairgrounds, ready to take horses all over the country. Most notably, back to Kentucky and some to Oaklawn and wherever else. And at some point, I don't know when I first saw the story that came off the Bluegrass Parkway east of Lexington, the Creech van that went off the road and killed three horses, Eddie Keneally's barn and clients, and hearts go out. I mean, what else can you say? It feels like there's one van-related calamity about every, 18 months, every 2 years. There was that insane cigarette that someone threw out a window that goes into a van window and ignites the straw. I mean, there's enough hazards and enough, sadness and elements of this that that make it hard and challenging, and then you get phone calls, like this. And so I don't know how much more there is to say. So many rescue parties, Haggard and Rudin Riddle vets got to the scene, took hours to extract the horses out of the box stalls. And it's just unbelievable. So, deep sympathies, and exchanged a simple text with Eddie, and Hammer. What do you say? It's one of those things that you just fairly unimaginable, as is what transpired 5 hours ago in Baltimore.
I was just going to say, I kind of liken that to what I woke up to this morning on the news. The first video I saw with the barge like ship hitting the base of the Francis Scott Key Bridge and watching it go down like a tinker toy. Yeah. Pretty sad.
It's horrific, and it's going to be an incredible. I mean, the tragic sides, and then the the infrastructure situation that will be potentially devastating for months in Baltimore. But
when you're in a game like we are, and you travel like we do, yeah, on the road, I mean, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of horse fans going up and down, left and right, not just thoroughbreds. I'm just talking, local horses moving from farm to farm or ranch to ranch. And, I always keep an eye and see how they're going. And I tell you what, I see most of these drivers are as safe and as taking care of business as I see. I always kind of do my duty and go, okay, you're all right. For a tragedy like this to happen, I see some. Is there a cause? Did they find out?
The reports are fairly incomplete. All they said was the van was crossing the median. And, I mean, the instant impression as you read it was the driver fell asleep. I mean, that came to mind. By no means is that. That was the first thing that popped in my head. It just horrific. It's hard enough. That's always the refrain. Simply that you get calls. You know, your horse gets hurt. You deal with that. You know. This is a call that you're on the other end of the line and you're just, you've got to be numb and just in disbelief. So many of them, as you say, unless you're in racing or in equestrian sport, you don't necessarily notice how many. And it doesn't have to. It could be goosenecks and single horse or twin vans. Horses are on the move all over the place. It's unbelievable. And once you sort of tune your eye to it, you know, you pull up, you see a van, you're driving, and you see a van in the front. Now you're curious.
I was trying to guess how many horses are in the van,
or whose it is. I mean, there's certain companies that have the reflective. The reflective steel, the mirrored steel. Others have the painted. Thoughts out to everybody. Just awful. Happy though to be here and to make the transition from fairgrounds. And thanks very much yesterday to Mikey DiLiberto and Shane Wilson for coming up to the press box. And I knew the DiLiberto portion of the conversation. I know you didn't get a chance to listen, but I got tremendous feedback. People just love the stories, and there's more. I wouldn't say there's more stories in New Orleans than anywhere else, but it sure feels like that. There's probably more characters per square foot than there is even, in New York or out here or anywhere. I mean, it is just a Runyon-esque setting that gets perpetuated. And the culture down there, I said this yesterday, Rick, the culture down there is really ingrained. There's no stigma attached to the racetrack in Louisiana and in New Orleans in particular. For instance, I didn't get a chance to mention this yesterday. Grant Forster, he's got potato skins. His Derby potato skins are named after him at Katie's. You go to Katie's Mid-City and Grant's Derby potato skins. You go to, of course, Brightson's, and there's Neil Pessin's, brass plate on his table. I mean, it's and there's probably tons more, examples. It's just part of the culture, and the food. There was an era when, I guess, at the old building in particular, guys would come from the business district, from Central Business District. They'd come out to the track for lunch. There was a food service history at Fairgrounds that
they had the soup of the day is the
origination.
Well, you always hear if a state could break away, you always think of Florida like they're their own state. Well, Louisiana definitely is part of that. They have their own rules, their own people, and I found the people rather friendly and entertaining, and like you said, characters all over the place. There's no shame in being being different, especially in New Orleans.
Well, I know I've said this off and on or periodically, but the cashing of a bet, you know, as the central focus, as the seedling for, you know, for every oak that grows in terms of racetrack lore. I mean, that's central to everything that goes on. And, you know, when there's money involved, it adds, you know, a dimension that is just, you know, irresistible. And you know, funny things happen. And you know, the story that DeLiberto told about, I'm not going to have to read, you got to listen, about locking up the repo man in a stall until they could cash the bet and so that the car didn't get repossessed. I mean, it's classics. These are things that, you know, you can't make these up. That's what's so appealing about racetrack lore.
Well, that's part of what's missing today at racetracks all over, stories like that. And, you know, just stop the goings on at the racetrack. And, you know, with agents being at the draw, kind of gone away.
That's
that adds
point.
To the, you know, the little bit of stir up every morning. Stories were told. Just COVID kind of stopped that, and we never went back to that. I'm one of the few, probably, racing secretaries around that I love the agents around. Because I like confusion. You know, yelling and people
tumult.
All over. I see that was my advantage. I could weed my way through it where others maybe couldn't. And so, you know, I had the music on, people in my office, TV's on, but I knew what I was doing, but it threw other people off. And so I missed the confusion. I missed the agents in there trying to do their thing and, you know, get a look at who's might be in a race or listen on the eerie to what might be going on and a little information they could get and relay back and the stories they would tell. You know, I've kind of tried to keep behind the counter a little bit, but I didn't mind walking around, hanging out in my office, telling stories. I would pretend I wasn't listening and glean a lot of information about horses and trainers, that I wouldn't get anywhere else from them. So, you know, I always say it's horse racing, but it's a people business. And that's really what it is. And we need to get back to that, social aspect of the game that I think. You know, like I said, I think COVID started and we haven't got all the way back to where we got so comfortable betting from the couch, so to speak, as opposed to, hey, let's go to the track today. You know, calling your buddy, let's go out to the track. And we need to get that part back because this is where it happens, is at the racetrack.
Exactly. I mean, the bricks and mortar, this is not to, you know, not to complain about the access. I mean, I'm somebody that has said, you know, for ages about virtual attendance. You know, I always bristle when somebody says, "Oh, well, no, but look, the track is empty." No, actually, the track is better attended than ever because there's people all over the country and all over the world that are actually attending, just not in person. I mean, I floated this. 15 years ago, taking the you know, the per capita, you know, the, you know, what they estimate, you know, the per person wagering is, and, you know, they do that. That's how they estimate attendance, right? Live, if you don't have turnstiles.
Well, the attendance is a different animal. Most places tend to over exaggerate the number.
Well, but there was a time.
There was a time when
you would take the handle and divide it by, you know, $120 or whatever, you know, the on track, meaning the on track.
Well, you could do a parking deal,
extrapolation,
per car.
Yeah.
Program sold. They had their own little formula out there, and you could come up with a real number,
right?
But you'll see some tracks put 5,000 and the on track handles, you know, 200,000, meaning that everyone's betting $22, which, you know, is not right.
No, But that, yeah, that there's more people attending. There's more people, especially the obscure, more obscure tracks, and you know, the smaller venues that, you know, that.
Well, that's what we need. That's our growth. I mean, you take like the Fauner Parks of the world. I mean, they go over.
Emerald. Let's talk Emerald for a second and what they did yesterday.
With the penny breakage?
Not just penny breakage. The penny breakage is great, and they didn't have to go to the legislature to get it done. They're also adding what they're calling the dynamic morning line. They're going to have an ongoing adjustment to the morning line, including extrapolating the line based on multi-race wagers. It's very player friendly and really player cognizant, and I mean widespread applause for Emerald. Their meet starts in May, and we'll have to get oh my gosh, is it Jeff Frazier? They need to, you know, saw some other comments the other day too. I saw Mike Dempsey put up a reminder about Hawthorne and Hawthorne's aggressive pricing on on their whips, and the players need to be supportive when they see venues that are they're not just doing it as a gimmick. I mean, they're trying to send a message that, you know, we appreciate the player and we want our offering to be attractive to you.
Well, we talked to Jim Miller in Vegas, and he very enthusiastic
very
about
much.
The start of the Hawthorne meet and the, you know, hopeful resurgence of Chicago racing and them trying to be part of a circuit. They're going to run from the spring to the fall and sometime in October, and hope to, you know, connect with Fairgrounds or Oaklawn and be part of a 2-3 track circuit, which is smart rather than trying to do the year-round number. And they got a few things going on that well, I'm sure we'll talk to Jim later once they get started. But things like that for the fans, when you do lower a couple of those takeout things going. So I think we're going to see more and more, hopefully, innovation locally for some of these tracks. And you mentioned Emerald Downs. Anybody that travels to the Northwest needs to go to Emerald Downs. One of the most picturesque tracks you'll ever see. We're looking over here and we see the San Gabriels. Over there you look out and you see Mount Rainier off in the
pretty
distance.
Cool.
Hopefully, if it's not cloudy. It's just a kind of a magical spot up there in the Pacific Northwest. But, Washington years ago was a thriving state, both breed-wise and racing. They had 4 or 5 tracks. They're down to Emerald now. And Emerald is in that boat where they need a sister track.
You know who might opine on this? John White.
You have his number. He's got all the numbers.
Actually, John texted me. I think he may come over this morning.
Great.
Or tomorrow. I'll touch base with him.
Yeah, so anyway, he can obviously tell you more, but the circuit up there.
Phil Ziegler. Phil Ziegler, not Jeff Frazier. I don't know why I came up with that.
I don't know. But like I said,
Z in it.
When I say they're looking for a sister track, they need they can't run all year long, but they need, you know, a track where their horses can go to and then go back. So I think we're going to start seeing some pairing like that to keep these local circuits going. But around here, you know, the last few days, the new question to ask, and I was going to ask you, is do you need an interpreter? Because we got this goofy thing going on with the
it's ugly.
Oh, it's and you know, it's one of those things, whatever you read, you, probably not true, but Pete Rose had the best line: if I only had an interpreter, I'd be in the Hall of Fame. I mean,
that's pretty good.
And it was that great. I mean, I don't know. Pretty wild. You come home and you just start reading this stuff, and every time you read a story, it's a little bit different.
It won't be the last. I mean, not obviously not the the interpreter side of it, but there's also there's a basketball scandal. I thought I saw brewing.
The Temple? No.
No, somewhere else. I just caught bits and pieces. I traveling yesterday did not have great news access. Bits and pieces when I stopped in Dallas. Speaking of the Dodgers, actually, by the time I got in at 8, and it was very. I had a very strange travel thing that you might appreciate. We leave New Orleans, going to stop in Dallas, LAX. So I get off in Dallas, and I haven't traveled through Dallas in ages.
Is that American?
Southwest, and it's funny, mostly on this trip on East West, when I've stopped in Texas, it's been at Austin, which is a fabulous little airport. But I get off the plane and there's the signage. It says, you know, it's got the placard with the, you know, your connecting city. And so I look, I said, you know, Los Angeles, LAX, and it's got gate 18. And instead of the arrow going left or right, the arrow has like a U-turn. And I look up over my shoulder, and we're at gate 18. And it says boarding in 17 minutes. Like, what is going on? And obviously, the plane is still sitting there. We just got off. So it turns out that was the termination of the flight to Dallas. And then the origination of further legs starting in Dallas. So
Same plane, same
crew. So we get off, we're 15 minutes and get back on the same plane. And I'm coming up the gangway and I see the woman at the attendant at the gate, at the door. And she goes, "Oh, hello again." I said, "What's going on?" She goes, flight change number. I've never had that happen.
Well, didn't they offer you to stay on the plane?
No. Everybody had to get off. Because I said to her, I talked to a different flight attendant. I said, I never heard a through passenger announcement. She goes, no, everybody had to get off. That was the termination, and this is an origination. It was very strange. Something else has happened on this trip. Fort Lauderdale, when I got to Fort Lauderdale for the Fountain of Youth, I forgot to mention this one. This is classic. First bag on the carousel. I've been traveling 40 years. I don't think I've ever had my bag come off first off the carousel.
I had my moment. You get it. I think you get it. I think you're awarded once a couple years ago. And it was actually, I remember where it was, because it was at Keeneland, because... I mean, it's at Lexington, and because I've lost two bags at Lexington that I eventually got, so I'm always on the alert. And it was one of those ones where my bag was kind of, I'm looking around, like, is this a setup or something? There it was. So I think you get your deal, you check it off, and it'll never happen again, but you take it when you can get it. Absolutely. Especially at LAX, because LAX is famous. If your plane lands at 10, you maybe have your person pick you up at 10:45 or 11, because the baggage weight is horrendous.
It was good last night. It was
lucked out.
It was very quick here last night. In fact, I've had it's been a good run on luggage. Although when I came in December, remember when I came in December, the bag
was that Southwest?
Southwest. It's always that's all I
because they have their own have their own terminal over there, and so they kind of internal stuff. They usually get it done quicker than most.
I had a late check-in. Wherever I was coming from, I must have been coming from Phoenix, which is hard to believe, actually. But I think I had a late check-in, and my bag did not make the flight. And I had to come back to LAX. You know, talk about an unpleasant experience. I had to come back to LAX to get the bag the next morning or the next afternoon after the show.
That's why you need to fly into Burbank.
I got to tell you, that whole shtick years ago when I used to have to go to Orange County, to John Wayne, I didn't like that either.
Don't like Burbank. You got a major situation.
There's one place where you have to literally walk 2 miles from the terminal to get to the rental car. There's not even it needs a shuttle, but it is a schlep up escalator, all over a thing of overpass, then down escalator.
There's not an escalator to be found.
Then someplace, and then what's the other? Where else would
Long Beach?
Maybe Long. I don't
John
know.
John Wayne.
That's been years since I
Ontario.
We used to go to John Wayne. We'd come to Orange County. A couple of other news and notes. Let's slip in. And again, the Emerald Down news was really nice. I should get the Todd Pletcher situation. The New York State Gaming Commission is going to hold Todd for this 14-day suspension and a $2,000 fine over a Butte overage. Todd's obviously got a bunch of prep, horses to go through toward the opening round of the classics in May. So he's the Karen Murphy swings into action. She's obviously had dealt with the Forte situation as well. This is Capensis, and it has got a few more legal wranglings yet to be executed.
A few more wrinkles, I think, right? And they'll prolong this to get point.
They call it an Article 78, which is straight out of Joseph Heller. And Catch 22 is the first thing I thought of. Article 78. So, yeah. This. And there was something else I had.
I've got to
go get my printer after the show, by the way, which is in
where
your
is
office.
It?
It's in your office under the little side table.
And we might have sold that by now.
I hope not, because I tell you what, I was very good in New Orleans. I did not. My Florida printer, Tom Ventura, if you're listening, it's in that empty office across from my Florida printer. Had been at Gulfstream under the desk at in Dave Joseph's office, but I took it with me and left it at OBS. So
I'm sure you'll be back through Ocala.
But I got to get it back at the start of the trip. There's the Moquette. Typically the Kentucky Oaklawn Fairgrounds printer, Moquette, moves it around. It has been known to.
That's pretty funny. I was just getting light enough out here. Well, A, to see Gary's studio over here, but B, to see horses on the new Tapeta surface over here, galloping.
Yeah, come here. We haven't
First
talked to you
I've
in too it. Long. Way too long. One of the talk about racetrack characters,
the one and only.
That might be the only nice thing you can say.
That's not true. The winner of the College Bowl pool this year. What was that worth?
$700.
There we go. Well done, and having a great winter.
Yeah, no, I've actually had pretty Del Mar. I started. They were all hitting the board. I just couldn't win. I mean, I had like 7 out of 9 seconds, but they all been running good. Just there's always one better. Thank you.
The whole racing world needs more studies, and I say that because they're great. But B, what Gary's favorite thing to do? Run his horses. Yeah. Loves to run them. Got that from his dad and his uncle. They like to run.
It's like I was telling somebody the other day, right? I was in a one of the then Calbert allowance race, right? And one horse had won the condition on the dirt, and it was a turf race. 6 out of the 8 had already made over 100,000. And on the other ones still had both their conditions left. Just I tell these guys all the time, if you want to last in this game here, you got to buy Calbreds. I mean, I get to run for the same maiden purse as Bob Baffert with a Calbred.
Well, that may, and that, that.
And you can run, you know, the races are pretty much going. And at 2 o'clock or 2:30, if you needed a horse or were in trouble,
call Gary.
Gary, you just say put him in. Which race? Just put him in. Wherever you need him. And I mean that sincerely. And in every racetrack has people that they count on. And for years,
when you were racing secondary, I got a horse in the first race, and I'm walking towards the paddock, and Hammer says, "You got anything for this race?" I said, "I'll see you in 10 minutes. Let me see how this one runs." And it ran. I forget where it ran, but when I came back, you'd already put it in.
I came back. He didn't wait for an answer.
It was already on. I told him, and I noticed the board never changed. He was already on the board.
Humphrey taught me that about you guys. Just put him in. That was like J.J. Krupe. You were the J.J. Krupe of the...
That's funny.
Oh, yeah. Because we had a thing here. You couldn't put him in. They couldn't... enter while they were where they are
already. He was an in today horse.
He was an in today horse, so we had to wait. Sometimes we'd wait. Okay, him or Barry. Barry would do the same thing. Yeah. All right, we got to wait till the fifth race is run because Barry's going to put that horse back in to make this race.
But yeah, perfect. I walked in to enter and I looked at the board and I gave it to him. And the board never changed. So I said, "Oh, I was already in."
That's tremendous.
You know, you got to do it. You got to know your. You got to know the room.
Well, like people don't realize, right? They all talk about, oh, you know, horses need all this time, right? I said, if my dad was alive now, I don't know what they do, because they all talk about the Triple Crown, right? Oh, it's too demanding on horses, back in 2 weeks and then back in 3 weeks, right? Snow Chief ran in the Derby, then the Preakness, came back 9 days later in the Jersey Derby. Yeah. 3 weeks was too long to wait.
Yeah, when they're good, you got to run them, right? That's what.
They would have killed my dad in the press.
It's a reality. I mean, it's one of those things. Run them when they're right.
Yeah.
What are you? You're gonna, as opposed to waiting and waiting and.
Yeah, I mean, Barry used to come in with his statistics here and about horses that he would run. 1, 2, 3, like three times in a month, and the third time was always the best. Was always the best one.
And he had all those Calbred allowance. I mean, those horses would make nothing but money. I mean, he'd rather run third or fourth in a race than work them.
See, what a concept! Yeah.
Well, but the one thing that certainly has happened that's a huge negative is the trainers that traditionally ran their horses into shape, you know, particularly at the beginning of the year, maybe gave them 75 days, 90 days, sent them to South Carolina, and then, you know, run them 3-4 times into shape. It hurt their percentage, and then all of a sudden, in the last 25 years, win percentage, something nobody gave a crap about forever, suddenly, oh, well, that guy only wins 11%. Yeah. But what are you talking about?
And when they bring that up all the time, right, it's like they wonder why they have small fields. Well, if every trainer wants to win at 25%, you're going to have a lot of four-horse fields.
Exactly right.
That's it.
I mean,
that's why we pay back to fifth usually.
But everything, but it doesn't help. Is emphasize our win percentage. Sure, in the money percentage.
It's there. It's there. It's in DRF.
Everything is win percentage.
Yeah. When new owners come into the game, that's something that they either we've conditioned them to think that way, but that's why people say, oh, the super trainer. Well, because new people come in and they gravitate to the guys that are winning that percentage. And then, of course, there's this whole mantra, oh, well, he's winning at such a high percentage. Yeah, because they're only running in spots where they know they've got an advantage and you know, they're keeping an eye on their win percentage. It's not good for
David
the game.
David Abrams was here the other day, Barry's brother, right? And we were talking, and he said, all Barry wanted to be is a 10% trainer. And I said, that was the same with my dad. That was his goal. If he got under 10, he was nervous, but as long as he was above 10, he was happy. Now these guys, if
you got to be 20,
if you're 20%, you can't train.
Yeah, unless you're an old school, unless you're, you know, like Shug and Mott, you know, 16, 17%. I mean, that with more than acceptable, but they've got, you know, they've got reputations that are, you know, and that, carry them.
Other thing I like is when they mention Baffert's win percentage and made a lot, right, it's a high percentage, I go, what they don't even point out, half the time he has two, so automatically one of them's a loser. So think what his real win percentage would be.
That's a good point. That's true.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
Gary, always tremendous. Gary Studi.
He's a true Clocker's Corner denizen.
Every morning, as long as I've been coming here, I get here typically 5:30, and he's here. You know who hasn't been here this morning? Glatt. But there's no real training,
he'll
right?
Be
today,
right.
It's light training.
Tuesday is no works on Tuesday. There's no Clockers here, so obviously you can go out and do what you got to do, jog around or gallop. Mark's here. It's not like he took the day off.
Oh, no,
you
know, he'll be around. Usually him and Carava are hanging out, you know?
Yep. Tom Canoost, going by.
Speaking of denizens, right?
No, he's always here. He was ex-racing secretary turned agent, and I'm not even quite sure who he has now.
But he always does.
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. But always is always has a good rider and has done a great job since he got out of the racing office.
Escape from the racing office. Do you want to?
Who do you have, Tom? Come here.
I don't know if Tom's ever been on, actually.
Tom's coming on right now.
Nice.
Like I mentioned, he was here doing what I did before.
All right, Tom.
And we were both happily survived the racing secretary job, and Tom has become a successful agent. I couldn't even
Antonio Frisou.
And you know what? I heard nothing but good about. And every time I come out, he wins two or three races. I'm seriously. Your first jock was Kent, right?
Kent DeSarmo, yeah.
Pick that up.
Oh, okay.
Pick that
Kent
up.
Kent DeSarmo.
And so made the transition. Look, after being a racer here for a while, you gotta unwind a little bit and then figure out what else you're gonna do in the game. And Tom went right to agenting and picked up a Hall of Famer and really.
Well, actually, before that, you forget Stablegate.com.
Stablegate.com. We could be flying around in jets and everything else right now. Just a couple of deals away, right? But when it all started,
we actually missed it by 2 years because the bubble broke right there, busted right on the cusp when we were trying to raise money for .com. And remember when .coms were going out of business? I mean, they're just going crazy. And then when the bubble burst, that was it. And we couldn't raise any money, and Stablegate.com went down the drain.
And we had to get real jobs.
Yeah.
So.
And then that's when I picked up Kent.
Yeah. If you want to call these real jobs, but...
Well, you do need a pin. Oh, I get that from the racing office. You do need a condition, but oh, I get that from the racing office. Well, maybe it's not a big investment.
Tom, at what point was that? That was that's not when he came out from Maryland.
No. He had been here, and he had been established, but then he had been kind of his business wasn't the best, and he was going to Japan back and forth. So he lost a lot of business here. So when I got him, he really wasn't riding much. And then we went to Del Mar, and he still was going back to Japan once in a while. And we were working all the horses for Mark Glatt at the time. Nobody else weren't working for anybody.
Huh.
And then one day...
And this is when? In the 2000s? Early 2000s?
This was been about 2000, yeah.
Yeah.
And 2001. And then... Bobby Frankel came by the racing office one day, and he said, anybody opening that filly mare once other than my on the turf? I said, Ken is. Put him on. The filly won by 22 lengths. And then from then on, Bobby started using him on everything. And the first book here at Santa Anita, we had like 33 calls for Bobby. And we won the Malibu. We won about every stake there was to begin with. And but then, unfortunately, when Bobby went back east, he had Jerry Bailey back there. So he said, I don't need DeSarmo back here. I got Jerry Bailey, and that didn't hold well with Kent. And so the first year I had Kent, it was great. The second year it was terrible. So, but Kent's a great rider, good person. But it's just a tough game, and these jocks, when they're doing well, they're good, and when they're doing bad, sometimes they're good, and then when they're doing really good, sometimes they're bad. So you just can never, you know, dictate their personalities, and I can see it because, you know, they go out there every day and risk their lives, and there's a lot of pressure on them, and they got to lose weight, and you know, it's a lot more to it than what people think.
Freisu has really,
yeah. Antonio's really been really
locked
good.
Himself in.
Yeah, yeah. I thank Leandro Mora, who works for Doug O'Neill,
sure.
Because he was over there in Dubai a few years, and he told me about this rider. And at one time, when he told me, I really couldn't take anybody because I had two riders. And then Victor Espinoza went back to his old agent, who had some personal problems with his wife, and she was sick, and he couldn't be here. So when he was able to come out, he took him back, which I can understand. But that left an opening for me at the time. So then I got together with Antonio, and he's been here almost a year now. And he's done real well, and he likes it. And it's been fortunate for me.
And he's taken – sometimes it takes a while to – I mean, years for – a new rider to come in. He hit the ground running.
Yeah, I think for what he did and everything, for the time he's been here, I think it's been pretty amazing. And I just credit his, you know, his work ethic and his ability. And then Doug O'Neill helped us out a lot when we first got here. And now we have Doug and Mark Glatt and Phil D'Amato and Peter Urton and Carla Gaines. And those are like our five main stables. And they're supporting us pretty well.
That's a nice roster of barns to be in.
Yes, so we're fortunate.
By the way, for those that were wondering about that Malibu, that had to be mizzenmast.
Yeah, and then the funny thing about mizzenmast was going to go ahead and run in the Santa Anita Handicap and was going to be the favorite. And I had another horse that John Dolan had. I can't think of the horse.
Oh, yeah.
And he wanted us to ride it, but I said, I've got Bobby. And, well, he said, well, I'll wait. Well, all of a sudden, mizzenmast got hurt. And I'm thinking to myself, I was going to tell him we could ride him, but then I said, Bobby had another horse.
Milwaukee Brew.
Who was going to be 20-1 in the Santa Anita Handicap. And John Dolan was going to be about 5-2. But I called Bobby, and he goes, yeah, you know, you can ride that other one. All right. And then the other one won by about 6 lengths, just demolished the field. So that's why it's sometimes better to go ahead and ride for trainers and don't try to handicap the horses.
I think I was telling a story about Milwaukee Brew because he won it twice, and now he had Medaglia d'Oro nominated the 1 year,
yeah.
and he was in. We were, you know, back and forth. You know, we'd get with the pound. Yeah, you should have done this. You did. And he was never running the horse. And then he drops Milwaukee Brew in again, and he wins again.
The funny thing about Medaglia is that he ran in a prep for the it was one of the races before the Belmont, and he got beat. And Jerry Bailey was on him, and Jerry Bailey didn't want to ride him ever again. Told Bobby, I don't want to ride this horse. So he called me up and he said, Kent can come out and ride him in the Belmont if he wants. Okay. So he's like 20-1 in the Belmont. He loses by a nose. And so Bobby runs the horse back in a stake in New York. He's 2-5 in the race and put Jerry Bailey back on him. And Kent just went ballistic. He didn't even ask him to come out and ride him. He put Bailey back on, and that was, you know, like I said, every time something like that would happen, then Kent would be tougher and tougher to work for because, again, you know, you have personalities, you have feelings, and it affects you. So.
I just got a text from Rich Migliori.
Oh, my man.
Your man. And he said, Tom had my book when we won the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, he is really rich. We used to go to Hollywood Park to work horses, and he'd tell me, you don't have to go with me. I said, I want to go with you. I want to hear your stories. I want you to tell me, you know, he's got so many stories and such a good guy and just such a good guy to work for. Yeah.
Talk about a guy who took hit the ground running here when Richard came out here.
He did,
right?
And he was just amazing writer, and his personality, he got along with people and was able to communicate with the horsemen, and just like job he's doing back in New York now and stuff.
He's perfect for what he does.
Oh, he's a very
and he, you know what he
and
learned how to ride that hill in 2 weeks. I mean, he was some You see or hear some stories about some guys going up there and coming down there the first time and what to do and who do I follow and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. He was immediate down that hill.
He's a very, very smart person, and he knows horse racing, and yeah, he was really a joy to work for.
And Rich, I asked him if he could join us with a call, but he's in a funky cell area. I can remember him talking about, and he's told the story several times about got him a mount early on, you know, when he first got here, and he said the horse taught him how to ride the hill. He said it was one of the, like a, you know, like a one veteran. Of like a Calibre Choa type or you know, well, that knew the hill.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, horses are herd animals, so when they're coming down that hill and when they're coming across that dirt, they just follow each other. And the one key, I think, for riding down the hill is that you want to be following somebody, and you want to go ahead and be, you know, within that mix. If sometimes the horses are by themselves and they hit that dirt, that's when they jump because, you know, it's something new to them and they don't follow anybody else, and you see it happen. But I love the hillside course. I think it's the safest thing that we have here at Santa Anita. And I'm just glad that they got us to be able to start running down the hill again. And I'm grateful for that, for what we can have. And I just think it's a great race.
Well, talk about a little bit about when you were racing secretary here. And when Tom was racing secretary, that stuff out there, the dirt, that was prominent. That was it. Yeah. A couple turf races a day, and they were special, and it wasn't that big of a deal. So it was kind of like, you know, old time racing. And then way before that, then they got the hill to use. I mean, that was when you decided to go to the races that day, and you got the form, you know, waited at the newsstand and got the form, and you turned the page, and there was a race down the hill. It was the greatest thing.
Well, you had the thing about running down the hill, you could take the milers and the sprinters and put them together, because milers do really good down the hill and the sprinters do really good. So, you know, instead of riding a race a mile on the turf and then three quarters on the turf, the same category, you could ride a 6.5 down the hill and just ride that one category and draw from all those horses. So it was a big, big advantage. And I just think that it's a very big asset, and actually just the aesthetics of it and racing in the country, it's probably one of the best races around.
And certainly for Rich, I mean, to add a Breeders' Cup win, you know, to his resume, it was perfect.
But like I said, he was just a pleasure to work for. And
how did you find him? Did he call the wrong number and you answered?
No, he was walking down Pasadena on the street and he was lost and didn't know where he was at. And I said, "Need a ride?" Honestly, I can't even tell you. I can't even remember how we got together, but he was, you know, again, it was really, really a experience for me, a pleasure to work for him. And like I said, he's such a good rider and such a person and such an interesting person. And that's why I'd go to Hollywood Park with him every day and drive him. And he'd say, "You don't have to go over." I said, "Yes, I do. I want to hear your stories."
He's got them.
He has a lot of them.
Rich, because it's such a long, his long, not only longevity from the career standpoint, but his childhood. And you know, he tells the stories about the ponies, the pony racing. And it just, you know, plus his, you know, New York background.
Well, he said that the worst thing about thing is there's a trainer that had his contract, and he didn't mind that every one of his money that he earned had to go to that trainer because of the contract. And when he won the Eclipse Award for the apprentice, he had to leave early because he had to get to the barn and do the tack before everybody got there. And then he told me the one thing he just hated the most is that he had to wash the trainer's car every week. And he hated that.
I've never heard him mention that. That's funny.
He said he could take everything else, but washing that trainer's car just killed him.
Tremendous, right? Tom Neust joining us, and you know, the the movement and tracking the horses. You know, I was at Fairgrounds this week, and I see Derek Lawson, who of course really got Flavian Pratt
going,
rolling. But having Pratt, sort of now moving everywhere, and there's more and more of it. I mean, it seemed, Johnny, you talk about Rich, Johnny Velasquez came out here and part of, hooking up with Ron Anderson. You know, this has been a very interesting coda, really, to his career. Dettori showing up here.
Dettori is a great rider, and he's really good friends with Antonio, and they're from actually the same city in Italy. And they're good friends, and when heard that he was coming out here, Antonio liked it. He said, the better the competition, the better you can ride. And he just likes having a lot of good riders out here, like Joel Rosario and J.J. Hernandez and Rispoli and Pratt. He didn't mind it at all. He thought it was better for his career just to go ahead and ride with those kind of riders. So.
And learn from them.
Yeah,
right.
100%.
How old is Fresu?
He's 73. He's 32.
32. So yeah. The prime.
Yeah. He had been 7 years. He was riding in Italy and he tried Europe a little bit, but then he was 7 years at Dubai for the winners. And did really good in Dubai. I think he was one of the top riders there for the 7 years. And then, but the thing about being here in California is if you want to have a Breeders' Cup horse or you want to have a Kentucky Derby horse, then you want to be in the United States, And he's fortunate enough now that he rides that horse Stronghold for...
I was just about to bring up...
Phil D'Amato.
Yep.
Who works sensationally
yesterday, right? Yesterday.
It was an unbelievable work. And so if he runs in the Santa Anita Derby, and I think if he runs 1, 2, 3, then he'll have enough points for the Kentucky Derby, and I think they want to go. So that'd be a great thing for Antonio to be in the Derby this year and experience that.
Well, and it's very timely that Stronghold sort of bubbled to the surface coming out of Sunland, out of the Sunland Derby win. And, everybody has this precluded decision that there's not going to be any horses from the West, and we're going to talk to Michael W. McCarthy at about 7:20 10:20 Eastern, and he endlessly was dominant at Turfway on Saturday, but he's not in McCarthy fashion, and the Ammermans. I mean, you got a client like the Ammermans, and a guy like Michael W. McCarthy. We'll be running at Churchill, but in the American turf, they're not going to go, rainbows.
The Ammermans are really good owners. They've been owners for a lot of years and stuff. And Bobby Frankel had some horses for the Ammerman.
Yeah.
And for about, when I was a jocks agent for about 12 years, I actually then was Bobby's stable agent. And I did all of Bobby's entries, all his nominations, everything for like 12 years. And only one time did I forget to enter a horse. And it was like a $62,000, $75,000, $80,000 claimer. And I forgot to enter it. So I told Bobby and his great wisdom and stuff said, you're calling the owner, you're calling Ammerman. So I called him, and Ammerman said, God, thank God. He says, I had that horse insured for $200,000. I didn't want to run him for $80,000. And the horse ran the next week in an allowance race and won. But Bobby never mentioned another word to me about it. So, but anyway, I worked for him like for 12 years. It was very interesting. Bobby's a very smart trainer, and very astute person, and very, very smart.
Oh, yeah. I always tell the stories of when he would come in my office, and we had always gotten along for some reason. And we would have arguments, and people would come to the door, and they would go, oh, my God, I can't go in there. And, little they know, it's just me and him going back and forth.
Yeah.
And when he would argue about weights or this or that and the other thing, I'd go, oh, okay. Then he'd leave the room, and I'd write down what he said, because a lot of times he was right, but he couldn't let him know it while you were talking to him. You know, you should look at this, and you should take this into consideration. And I'm like, oh, geez, he's right.
Well, he would take and be like a backseat, you know, backseat driver or money quarterback. But one time, I woke up and my wife said, "Well, you're on the paper." Because we had just weighted a race, and Bobby didn't like the weights and stuff.
Well, I was going to ask about this.
So she says, "Well, you're in the headlines in the sports thing." Oh, really? And the headline said, "Tom Canoose should be a bartender in Fresno." You know, the quote from Bobby Frankel.
Yeah. Well, probably over 1 pound, usually.
Oh, it was 1 pound. Yeah, he was. He just wanted. It was like that ref, you know, yelling at the umpire when you know you're wrong, but you keep yelling at him. So the next time you might get something called for you. That's the way Bobby was, and it made a big difference to him. But I've always been a believer that weights are important in horse racing. Some people don't believe it, but I believe it. And even if it's not important in actuality, the perception to the bettor, it's important. And you can get people to bet a horse that maybe he's going to be 20-1 because of the weight difference. You know, you can't, you know, they don't want to bet the
not,
one
not
to buy
now,
a shot.
But
yeah,
but
I mean, years ago. Historically, and this whole discussion, actually, the weight for age, you know, versus handicap, you know, concept. I mean, it's amazing how it just sort of faded away. Well, I mean, and Rick, you guys both presided over this era that saw handicaps kind of so evaporate.
Well, one of the reasons was take California. We're a year-round circuit, so we would see the horses come, and we could weight them as they, you know, up or down the little scale. 21, 22. He won a race, make 23. He lost one, drop it down. Then they would leave and go to a track that only ran, you know, had a small season and was never going to see this horse again. Well, they would wait him so he would come. So we'd be putting 22, 23 on a horse. They'd go somewhere else and give him 17 or 18 just to get him to show up there, throw off the whole darn scale, and it would happen all the time. And it was one of the reasons where there wasn't continuity in putting the right weight. Necessarily the right raises on these horses.
You're 100% right, because what happened was marketing got involved in it. And then when John Henry was running, and the owner, that Sam Rubin, said, "I won't run any place that they put more than 26 on the horse." And marketing had come into office and say, "Listen, we can get 5,000 more people with John Henry running,
right?
So you can't put more than 26 on him." I remember, and nobody ever says anything about it, but Zenyatta won at Hollywood Park a grade one carrying 124. And it was a handicap. He goes to Del Mar in the handicap, which is a handicap, which was a grade two, and Robbins dropped him 2 pounds and gave her 22. And nobody said a word about it because they wanted Zenyatta to run there. So marketing and he got more involved in the weights things. And
she might have been one of the last ones that really mattered, or you lost some sleep over, because I remember the time that she had won the Breeders' Cup here, and I don't think it was the colt race. It might have been when she won the Philly race 1 year, the first year.
I think
she won that race.
Yeah, so the
she won
Ladies Classic.
And so she was kind of coming back, and it was one of those early races. I don't think it was the Santa Margarita, maybe the Santa Maria, one of those. And I was sitting in the box, and I got someone say, "Hey, John's waiting for you in the office." I'm thinking, "Oh, okay, no big deal." I said, "All right, yeah." And I ran into somebody else, and they said, "Well, John, hey, John was looking for you." And I thought, "Oh, he must want something, because he never came in." I was going in there, and he's sitting in my little chair on the side. And, "Hey, what's going on?" The weight that you gave, I think we gave 126 or something. It was her highest weight, but I mean, she just won a Breeders' Cup. She's running here. And he was real concerned, and I'm thinking to myself, "Oh my God, I thought that was the right weight and the whole thing." And I'm like, "Oh, she's not going to run." And I'll tell you what, and the thing about it with Zenyatta, every race, there was a point where you thought she wasn't going to get there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what was so special about her. And I remember watching the race going, "Oh my God, she's going to lose. I'm done. I'm always over." And of course, she came out and ended up winning.
Usually to a Jamgochian.
Jammer
had those two, at the right, those two bears.
Mike Mitchell had a filly that was real competitive with her. But I remember watching this race. I never rooted for a horse quite quietly so much of my life. "Come on, Mike, move, make the move."
Satan's Quick Chick.
Oh, really?
Right? Satan's Quick Chick? Wasn't that one of the...
I don't remember that, but horse, no. But no, um, And I'll tell you what, nobody was more relieved than probably race tickets around the country just to say, hey, make them the same. And the debate was, and Tom has a good debate, that the debate was also, too, once you got to the championship level, that grade one level, you should probably be the same. And
the one thing is, I think we as an industry have to remember is that we drive purses from betting. And you need to encourage people to bet, you know. And so sometimes when a horse is 1-5, you don't want to bet on them because you're not getting any value. And you don't want to bet against them because you don't can't beat them. So I think that hurts your handle. But you do have an obligation. The one thing about weight for age and stuff, people know what they're going to carry going in.
Exactly.
The thing with handicaps, you never know.
So that's
a big difference between the two.
And also, you don't have like the Bill Shoemakers who could make 110, and you know what I'm saying, take advantage of the weight. You can't really weight a handicap lower than 116.
Or I'd say even 18.
You're 18. And that's fine. Right, that's fine with me because you know these jockeys, these athletes have grown, and the things they used to do to make weight, so to speak. I understand that. And so if you start at 16 or 18, then you go up from there, then they're carrying, you know, 26, 27. And, you know, where's that line where too much is too? One thing that Bobby did, talk about weights, that he kind of got in my head, he goes, you can't just keep piling weight on this horse till they lose. You know, you find their weight and just keep it. And you know what? That really hit me right, because that's what we would do. Okay, let's keep raising them. Now, okay, when he loses, then we'll come down. And he was right about that. You can't just keep waiting and putting weight on until they lose. Well, find a weight that's right for this horse, and then weight the others accordingly by going down. And I was one of those things.
Well, and Bobby's understanding of that came from the whole basis for his approach, which came out of the grandstand, as a bettor. I mean, right? That you know, from an era when, you know, weight was one of your big determining factors. You know, horses running every, you know, 2 to 3 weeks.
Well, he was a claimant trainer. Wasn't a big deal.
But he didn't understand, too, we're waiting these races, and you've got three or four people waiting them, and then you put your weights together and come up with a thing. But you're doing other things at the same time. You're filling entries. You're answering phone calls. You're still busy. Bobby, when the weights came out, then would go ahead and sit down and start analyzing it, and then he'd say, did you see here, this horse gave him 2 pounds and won. Now you're going ahead and giving that horse only 1 pound, and he beat him. And he'd go like that, try to find a pound here and find there. But he'd probably work on it for like 5 or 6 hours uninterrupted, you know. So, you know, it's not, you know, it wasn't like an exact science.
When he would come summers at Saratoga, so much fun to have. I used to get to feed him at the barbecue. Siaka started bringing him by.
I'll tell you one fast pleasure. Story. When I was there was a stake on the dirt, and he was back east, and I said, do you want to nominate to it? And he goes, yeah, you nominate to it. So then I nominated. So now, day of entries, I asked, do you want to run? And he said, yeah. And I told Humberto that he's running in their race. So he's back there, and the horse is coming on the track, and the announcers on TVG are going, yeah, you know what? Bobby Frankel is a Hall of Fame trainer, and if he thinks this grass horse can run on the dirt, then he knows what he's doing. My phone rings, you idiot. You didn't tell me this race was on the dirt. I said, I thought you knew it was on the dirt. You stupid. And hung on me. Now the horse wins by like 6 lengths. And they are going, yeah, we told you, Bobby Frank is a Hall of Fame trainer. He knows what he's doing. Bobby never called me back.
That's tremendous.
It's not an exact science, that's for sure. So
no. Okay. And then the introduction of a third surface makes it even
harder. But another guy, we didn't induct this dude. Bobby liked to run his horses.
Yeah.
I mean, he made a plan. He would come in at the beginning of the year, I'm sure he talked it over with you, and he would get, when we hit Judmont and whatever, you go, this one's going to go here, this one's going to go here, this one's going to go here, and I'll be done.
When I had DeSormo's book, I went over there one day, and he had just gotten 3 horses from Europe. And he goes, you see this horse? He's a grade one winner. He sells it for two other than. Do you see that horse? This horse is a grade one place. He sells it for once other than. See the other horse? He's a grade two winner. He sells it for two other. Now, you're not going to ride any of these. What are you telling me for then?
Well, he would do the same thing. He would run it. Yeah. But now, how come he can't tell a Bobby Frankel story without
talking? The voice.
It's automatic. It's drilled into that.
He would work horses every Christmas day here at Santa Anita because Hollywood Park would close. And he'd come over here and he'd be, and Humberto would have the day off. And whenever I had a rider, I always made sure that I was here Christmas morning working horses for him because I knew he was going to do it every.
And you could catch a mount or two.
Well, maybe sometimes, most time not, but you had to try. So, but that was every Christmas day he'd be working horses here.
I love that. That's funny because we think of Christmas these days, right? Walk day now these days, right? Nobody, the tracks aren't gallop. You can gallop.
Here's a little different. Well, here's different. But I meant 10 years ago, it was open for training, right? Maybe close at 8 or something. But you could, because we open the next day, obviously.
That's right. That's true. You guys are special.
One more story before I go. Yeah. Let me tell you. I was stall man at Del Mar. This is like 45 years ago. And I had never met Bobby Frankel before. And there was a little shack that we had. And I had, like, day before horses, we were going to start right. And it was really busy. People wanted tack rooms, everything. And Bobby came up to me, and he goes, who's the stall man? And I said, I am, but I'm busy right now with these people. And he started yelling at me because where his barn was, the limit was 32 stalls. And his barn was 30 stalls. And two pens in the back because there was no room. He wanted two more stalls. He said, I want two more stalls. How many does Charlie Whittingham have? And I said, 32, but his barn has 32 stalls. And he kept on me. And it was like my breaking point of working there for the first time as a stable superintendent. So I said, Mr. Frankel, can I talk to you around the back for a second? And he goes, yeah. So we go in the back and I said, if you ask me for two more stalls one more time, I'm going to beat the hell out of you. I don't care if I lose my job. I don't care anything. So I said, ask me for two more stalls. He didn't. He left. And then that next day, I was going by his barn. He says, you know, I'm not mad at you. It's just this place. I didn't like this place, these pens and stuff and everything. So I almost lost my whole career. I'd never been in horse racing after that. If I would have got a fight with him. So. But anyway.
I love it.
It's good talking to you guys.
Tom, a real pleasure and overdue, and get lucky. I mean, I'll be here all next week and through Santa Anita Derby.
Great. Hopefully we'll get lucky with that horse.
Yeah, Stronghold is serious.
And I said, if you get a chance to look at that work yesterday, it was pretty amazing. And after he came by me and worked, I had a text. So I just looked at my text. When I looked up, he was already around back in front of me again. All the way, he had galloped out all the way around, and it had to be within, I don't know, a minute. I mean,
really?
it was pretty impressive. So, anyway, hopefully we'll get lucky.
Who else? You know, I should ask too. You just won. I watched the replay because I didn't see it live. Missed the cut.
Yeah,
right.
He ran really well
in the San Luis Rey on Saturday. And who else is he? Who else is he sitting on that we're going to see maybe next weekend?
Well, I honestly mean. We've got, I think right now, but I probably shouldn't say anything because I don't know if the trainer they've worked it out with his owners, but there's a horse for the Oaks that I think we can be able to ride.
Nice.
And then even some of the undercard, we've got some really nice horses and just in the allowance races. So I think we can have a pretty big day that day.
How good is this Ghost of Midnight that seems like he's going somewhere?
he's an unbelievable horse. I would have to think that the night before he ran in that maiden 20, Glatt didn't get too much sleep because running that horse for maiden 20, but he got away with it. And I think had he not drawn the one hole, I think that they would have been real confident of him winning that first time out. But in the one hole, I don't think, maybe they thought, all right. But he's an amazing horse. But I think it looks like he might be running. I don't think there's really anything for him here in the near future. So he might be running at Keeneland or something like that. But But he's an exceptionally good horse.
That's for the sure. Kirkwoods.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Coming out of the San Carlos, which was his stake debut.
Yeah, and he ran a great race. I mean, the horse...
Chosen Vron is, yeah, a, I mean, is a...
What, he's what, 16 wins? I mean, every time he runs, he shows up. And I was hoping that he was going to wait for the down-the-hill race for the Cowbreds, but the one race he rode down, ran down the hill, he didn't handle it that well. So they probably made the right. And I mean, Eric's done a great job with that horse, so...
He's a Ghost Sapper gelding, too. He's going to be around.
Yeah.
He's not going anywhere.
He's only six, right? Just turned six?
He just turned six.
Yeah, he broke his maiden at six.
Yeah, I was going to say, right?
Or it may have been five. Maybe it was the beginning of last year. Yeah. But he was, I mean.
September.
Yeah, and the funny thing about it is, I think I had another horse for that maiden 20, and I wasn't thinking. And then they asked me, and I gave him the call, and then somebody asked me, and I got some first-time starter for Glatt. But had no idea that horse could run, or I would have bet.
What's interesting, maiden 20, and then Glatt has run him five times. He's obviously got starter eligible. Then he ran him in some optional allowance-type spots before he gave him the stakes debut. Horse has never been worse than second.
Well, what I tried to talk him into, but he's not going to do it, at Keeneland, like this, during we had this little break here, there's horses that have started for 20 or less in 23, 24. 60,000 up per going 7/8.
That's tailor-made for him.
How would that be?
Wow.
But he said, I don't want to ship back there just for 60,000. So there's.
But they'll get a Julep Cup.
Well, I know. And we could win a race back there. But yeah, he wasn't too enthused with it, so
he wasn't impressed.
Yeah.
Well, Tom Knuth, what a delight!
Thank you very much.
Let me get a picture of you and Hammer.
He's gonna want a check or something for this.
Oh yeah, of course.
Here, pull together a little closer. There we go. And I didn't get a shot of Studi. There we go. Over here, Hammer. Camera's over here. There we go. All right. Outstanding. Thank you, Tom. Real pleasure. We love that. That's why you come. That's why we, like yesterday, why you throw the line in the water and.
No, I knew it. Tom's great. We have a great time kidding each other. You can imagine. Now we're two ex racing secretaries here. We have a lot of stories. And he does a lot of work with Doug O'Neill, who's just great to be around. So a lot of kidding up there in suite number one during the day. You go in there, you better be ready, because no holds barred. Anything could be said about anything. And good guys, you can tell.
I had to pull up the Zenyatta PPs. It was not Satan's Quick Check, although I think she did run against Zenyatta. Tough Tizzes Sis.
That rings a bell.
They hooked up, and there was also the win in the Hirsch.
Yeah, what was the race I was talking? The race after the Breeders' Cup, where she came back, she carried. I think it was 126.
She ran the first race back actually after that ladies classic win was the Milady.
Maybe it was after
the big classic Santa Margarita.
That was the one
Santa Margarita. She carried 127. Was that assigned or was Mike overweight?
No, that's the weight we're talking about.
That was the 127.
That was the 127. Mike's not 127, but yeah, no. That was the one that we were sitting in the thing there. And then
she won the Apple Blossom, the Vanity, the Hirsch again, the Lady Secret.
Oh yeah,
again, and then came the.
But like
Churchill.
I said, the something about, you know, there's a you could win. You could be a horse that goes wire to wire every time, and it's great. And it's like, oh wow, this is fantastic. But the visual thrill of her watching her, you know, have to come from behind, and believe me. Watching, I think, live most of her races, all but one or two, there really was a time in every single race where there's no way that she was going to make it. And Mike knew when to hit the button, knew exactly what he had, Mike Smith, and you know, got her up, and boy, what a crowd pleaser she was.
You know what's what is not mentioned, at least I don't hear it mentioned often, the fact that he didn't ride her every start. The first three starts.
I forget who was on.
David Flores rode her in the maiden breaker, in an allowance win, and in the L Encino. Did that? What does that become?
The L. What does it become? A flower pot. I mean, it's gone. We had when we first came.
It was grade two at the time.
Yeah, that was part of the four-year-old filly series, like the Stroob series for the boys. It was part of that, and you know, they just got.
So they went La Brea, El Encino, Santa.
To the Santa Margarita, which was the big one, and then of course the
La Cañada.
Was that a, that might have
was that is
that, that might have been 4 year olds as well. That might have been the third one that led to the Santa Margarita, and then we had the Malibu, San Fernando, the Stroob, and then the Santa Anita Handicap.
Right,
and then right around then, that could have been the last El Encino. Right around that time, it was the. We decided there just weren't enough Colts or Phillies to have the two divisions. They just were, there were four straight 4 year olds. And so it just wasn't enough. So we just combined them and kind of weeded them out one at a time.
Wow.
Back then.
That's funny to say that.
2008 or 9 or whatever it was.
Yeah, 2008. So David Flores rode those first three, and then Smith took over for the Apple Blossom, that first Apple Blossom win at Oaklawn.
Well, that was that the first time she left town?
Yes.
So, you know, A, there was the, oh, she can just win it in California, which at that time was, if you could just win in California, you're a nice horse. And, of course, was a lot of synthetic action going on then, too, that, oh, she's just one of those. And so that was a big, huge, that was a big deal.
Well, both times that she ran and won the Apple Blossom.
That first time, that just to show that she's a little bit more.
And now I'm trying to remember. I think it was, I guess it would have been in 09, right? That she shipped to Churchill and didn't run the track conditions, and John did not want to run her. I'm pretty sure, and then so she waited for the Milady, and then she started
back up again.
Back up again to start her what? That would have been her 5-year-old year, 4-year-old year. Is that 4 or 5?
Probably 5.
5, I think. Yeah. And in terms of the most exciting or narrow victories, there was the one in the Vanity over Tough Tis a Sis. And it was the Hirsch here, or Del Mar, I should say, that she barely got up over Anaba's Creation.
Whose horse was that? Was that the Mitchell horse? I know Mike had a couple horses in there that he would run Anaba, against her.
I want to say Carla Gaines, but I'll tell you.
We're going to have to.
I will tell you right away.
Go to the videotape.
Perfect. A couple of minutes, Michael W. McCarthy will join us, and we will we'll talk about Endlessly. And you know, regarding the Ammermans, this is a pretty for a group that's, you know, for a family that's been around for a while. They may be enjoying their most productive period. I mean, not only has this Endlessly bubbled to the surface, Oscar Performance is going insane. Oscar Performance is busting out.
Yeah, good for them.
That's their biggest. I think their biggest earner.
That may be.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been in the game a long time here. Very, very. I don't know Mr. Ammerman well. I met him a few times. Just a very soft-spoken gentleman. If I had to describe him in a couple words, I look over. I see Ron McAnally over there. I'm going to have to hide and say hi to Ron, who comes out in the mornings and still shows his Face Randall loves it. Just looking at him, watching the horses go by, and with Alex Purcell, longtime agent here, who guides him around. Great family, McAnally's.
Anaba's creation was Julio Canani.
Julio Canani.
How about that?
I could hear him talking right now. And if he would have won, if there she would have won, we'd still hear him talking.
What a surprise! If I can, where's John Ortiz when we need him?
Where is John Ortiz?
Which one? John Ortiz the actor? John Ortiz, he's in a million things.
I know he is.
Look up, but it's impossible. I don't think Jay Hovde's listening, because Jay would have given us the correct order of those 3 to 4 year old sequences. That's a pet favorite of his. Anaba's creation was a Prestonwood.
Prestonwood Farm. Yeah. When they out of Texas.
Yeah. It was out of. I think Preston homebred.
Huh. I haven't heard that name in a while.
Yep. Well, they're gone. Right. Was it Jack? The brothers, right? There were.
I think it
two
was
or three.
Maybe three.
Yeah. I didn't. I would not have. I would not have come up with that. But yeah, the Zenyatta's deep closing antics. Some of the other, you know, it's funny that I could have sworn there was a horse of, I'm almost positive there was one of, and maybe the Tough Tis Assist was Baffert, right? I think she was Baffert. Coco beat Bree Cat in the Vanity
You're talking about Jam Gotchin? He had a horse at Delmar. Look at the Delmar races. He had some horses in there that ran.
She barely got past, is it Rinterval? Was Rinterval the?
I don't know. They're not necessarily household names, some of them. But they sure ran their eyeballs out when they ran against her, I'll tell you. Well, now that the sun, the sun and the clouds are up.
Rinterval. Rinterval is the one. Is the Uncle Neil? The Rinterval was the Jam Gotchin horse.
Stop back. Tell a few stories. Neil Drysdale, who's just—he's out here in the morning with a big smile on his face most of the time when I come out. It's great to see. But you know, this is—you sit back and as the darkness becomes light and a few clouds overhead, but you just stare out there at those mountains.
It's gorgeous.
And you go, oh, okay, now I see why I come here every day, type of thing. I would pull up to the stable gate knowing it was going to be a rough, tough, bad day, and you turn the corner, you go, okay, could be worse. I could be in an office somewhere. Like I said, the Lucky Baldwin 100 years ago, whenever he thought about, hey, you know, let's put a racetrack right here. Thank you. Appreciate that. But I look, we're down at the end of the course at the top of the stretch at Clocker's Corner, and had just looked down at the clubhouse turn, how far big this magnificent grandstand is. It brings back a lot of memories. A young writer, I don't have his name, texted me a couple last week, and he said, hey, would you mind doing me a favor? I'm writing a little book. Would you mind jotting down a couple paragraphs about your favorite Sanity to Handicap? Right? And I said, all right. And this was before I got to go to Vegas, da, 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 and I said, I'll get back to you. So he reminded me, politely reminded me the other day, and I said, you know what? So I got down last night, and I sat down, and I kind of closed my eyes, and I came up with one. And so you got to remember, I started coming to the races in the 70s, mid-70s, and Hollywood Park was the first track that I went to, and of course it went to Del Mar as well, but Santa Anita, I don't know, seemed to be the home track. You know, on my birthday, it opened, and spent many, many, many years out in that infield out there. And I've seen Spectacular Bid, Affirm, John Henry, Ali Sheba, Bates Motel, Interco. I mean, just a lot of nice horses running and win. But the one I was thinking, the one that stood out for me was 1978 Vigers, the White Tornado. And here was this big, literally white horse that started out as a turf horse, actually. And they put him on the dirt. He responded well. And I just remember that day coming out with 5, 6, 7, 8 friends in the infield, sitting on a blanket. And of course, when you bring new people to the racetrack, they're looking at you like for a winner, right? They just want to know who's going to win the race type of thing. And didn't always, but I was telling about this white horse in the feature race, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, and what made Vigers so, was a fan favorite, was his color, because he was literally white. But his running style, Zenyatta-like, he would just drop to the back and just, it was almost like the gates would open. He would just stop, wait for everybody to go, and then he'd kind of pick up his pace a little bit. But, and he was a fan favorite, and they called him the White Tornado. And sure enough, riding, I think it was 10 horses in the race. You can watch the YouTube on it. And sure enough, the gates open. He drops towards the back, and he's got to be 20 lengths back in the backside. And I mean, I just remember my friends looking at me like, What are you doing here? What kind of tip is that, right? And sure enough, he picked it up, and he made Dave Johnson, I think, was the announcer at the time, and he made every call then after a while, you know, and here comes Vigers, makes this nice wide move, and of course goes on to win. And to top it off, Daryl McCarg was riding him that day, and Daryl was having a great day. He had 5 wins up until that point, and Vigers was his 6th win of the day.
Wow.
And just one of those days that stands out, because everybody won, and I was king for a day, and Daryl had won 6, and even when I see Daryl now, I always bring that day up, and he gets a big smile on his face. But it's funny how you remember certain things and what stands out. But Vigers, the White Tornado, that's the one that stood out for me, so I wrote a little piece for I think Alan French is his name, if he's listening. Give you a little plug, whatever book you're writing, we hope we helped out. But and of course, every time I would stare at it, was every time I see Ron McAnally, of course, we think of the great John Henry. And now we've got sitting next to us the great Michael McCarthy, winner of the once known Jim Beam, and now
Jim Beam, the Spiral, the GalleryFurniture.com, the what else? There's a few other names.
I don't know, but it's the Jeff Ruby now, and they still pay off in dollars, and at the refurbished Turfway Park.
Brand new, and I'm sure is there a dining gift certificate?
They had a marquee set up right outside the paddock, and then they had, tables for runners in the Ruby and stuff like that. It was actually a nice setup, you know, it's some new facility and plenty of space and comfortable setting, so it was a nice day.
Well, and a nice win, and the most refreshing part of the whole thing, everyone applauding your response, which is, yes, we're coming to Churchill to run in the American turf.
That's what I would like to do. I've seen him several times on the dirt here. His workouts have been average at best most of the time, indicative of a true turf horse. Our racetrack surface here is a little bit deeper than most, so I would say even on the best of days, a very good workhorse can kind of fool you here. But his best days are in front of him and are on the grass. I would like to run in the American turf.
That's a mile and a 16th, correct?
Mile and a 16th.
Talk a little bit too about the just reaching for the chart. Talk about the development, and I was making the point when I saw that you were over there and you were going to come over. The Ammermans are enjoying as great a series of successes, both on the racetrack and in the breeding shed with Oscar Performance, I think, as they've ever had.
I think it's a great story. Obviously, they've put a lot into the game. Great denizens of California racing here, farm owners, Peacefield Farm. So it's nice for them to kind of be rewarded for, all of their efforts in all facets of the game. I think Oscar performance, the sky's the limit for him. He could be any kind of stallion down the road. And as far as endlessly goes, I think the sky is the limit for him, too. So great for everybody involved, great for the Ammermans, great for Mill Ridge Farm. Just a great day. Great day for Umberto Rispoli, rode the winner of the Rushaway and obviously Endlessly, both owned by the Ammermans. So that a career day for the for most involved.
For Endlessly, let's and you hooked up with Rispoli with Endlessly at Golden Gate for the El Camino. And, you know, for those that haven't noticed, I mean, his only blemish in six career starts was the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, where he did not run badly.
Still hard to believe he got beat that day. I didn't think there was a horse on the grounds that may have been doing better than him at the time. Way things unfolded, they went the opening quarter of a mile, I believe, in 22-3, and he was three quarters of a length off the lead outside. Basically a trip like he had never had before. All of his trips were all sort of speed stalking, tucking in, and making it that explosive late run. But wasn't to be that day. The racing gods had other ideas, so we regrouped, gave him a little small freshening afterwards, and didn't really have a target race in mind. The stakes schedule here at Santa Anita was you either run December 30th or March 8th. Neither one really fit into our plans, so the El Camino Real Derby made the most sense. Answered a lot of questions that day. First time traveling to run. First time going a mile and an eighth. First time on the synthetic. So he answered all those questions, and it just seemed like timing-wise, a race like the Jeff Ruby with a lucrative purse and back on a synthetic racetrack made the most sense.
I want to ask a quick question here that a little bit off, that'll take us all the other way. You mentioned first time traveling. You obviously worked for Todd for all those years and made a lot of road trips with a lot of horses. Can you tell immediately, well, when do you know when the horse is a traveler? I mean, when he gets off the van, when, you know, or do you get off the van and go, oh, my gosh.
I think you find out fairly quickly whether they like it or not. You know, it's a lot to throw at them. These days, we don't have the luxury of Tex Sutton, which was swift and organized. Now you're at the mercy of Federal Express. You're shipping to the airport. You're there hours earlier. You're flying to a destination that may not necessarily be
close
within the vicinity of the locale that you need to get to. So there's a lot of waiting. There's a lot of traveling. There's a lot of downtime involved. And then obviously you're getting to these racetracks late at night or in an inopportune time. So you have a pretty good idea of what your horse is like once he gets there, trains over the track for a day or two or schooling him in the paddock. Each horse is different. But the fortunate thing is most of the time, you're sending a good horse to these sort of places, so they have a touch of class about them. They take everything in stride.
Yeah, I was just wondering about that. And it's mentioned the plane. It's being worked on, getting in another plane. Just really? It's in the works. It's in the works. It's been thought about. It's been working on.
We heard a little bit about the whole situation. Andy Simoff explained some of the things that went on with this, with the leasing of the plane and those arrangements and... Yeah.
I don't think you guys need me to tell you, but obviously you look at some of these fields on some of these big days, and West Coast races are lacking a little bit of the East Coast flavor and vice versa. You know, around Christmas time here, obviously a great day of racing. One of the best days of racing is opening day at Santa Anita. Horses were forced to get out here weeks before opening day because of travel arrangements.
Or van. Because FedEx delivers packages instead of horses.
And so
we're at the mercy of that. So
an airline, a freightliner designed specifically for equine travel would be a big bonus for us right now.
It's literally, it's being worked on. So
cool.
I just want
to talk about, you mentioned the mile and the eighth. It's a demanding distance to bring a horse back for a seasonal debut.
That was the one thing that I wasn't crazy about. Obviously he handled it fine that day. You saw here the way he finished inside from the quarter pole to the wire at Turfway Park. The mile and eighth obviously wasn't an issue again, and running away from horses this time. I don't know how far he wants to run, but I think a mile and an eighth and a mile and a quarter, or, you know, maybe even a touch farther somewhere down the road, maybe in the cards. I don't know. We're taking it race by race with him, and certainly enjoying it.
I'll discuss the pedigree tomorrow with Sid Fernando as it happens. But, you know, this is an Oscar performance. So, you know, helping author the success that the stallion is enjoying. But I don't know how far back you've looked or if you've discussed it with Mr. Ammerman. The second dam, first dam was unraced. Dream for Forever, a Langfure, but her dam, Society Dream, Neil Drysdale trained.
Exactly. He mentioned that to me yesterday.
I
remember him having
just walked
horses
by.
Back two decades ago for the Emmermans, I believe, something like that.
Yeah, they've been here. They've had horses for a long time with Bobby. And
that's going a ways back.
Well, and that second dam was bred by Jean-Luc Legardeur,
one of the great French breeders. But of course,
oui.
Sacrifice. This is exciting for you, obviously, and you know, one thing about this, you know, shows, you know, any kind of horse, and you know, finding a path and making the most. I mean, 5 for 6.
5 for 6.
So you had that. You won the El Camino. Right, probably maybe the last El Camino.
Unfortunately,
and that gave you a ticket to the Preakness. Meaning, when I say ticket to the Preakness, there's a deal. There was a an agreement that the winner of that race got an entrance into the an entrance into the starting gate and fees paid, which you took advantage of a few years ago with Rombauer, and it worked out just fine. Was there any
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. Rombauer, a little different type of horse, seemed to get over the dirt just fine, had a couple of very good works, was second in the American Pharaoh as a two-year-old here at Santa Anita, so he had some dirt for him there to back that up. Pimlico Racetrack is a little tighter, a little faster than what we're dealing with out here, but... as I've said, I think there's blue skies ahead on the grass for this horse, so
and
we'll try to take advantage of that.
One thing that's for sure is there's plenty of opportunity for grass racing around the country, and especially wait till you see the Kentucky Downs stake schedule. I think you'll mark that on your schedule.
Sounds like there's big things on the horizon at Kentucky Downs. Everybody knows already the purses there. Just... hard not to pay attention to. We'll see what happens come late August, you know.
Well, and you actually are already well positioned. You know, you made an incursion into Kentucky and put a nice base down there, and you were one of the first, right? I mean, I think Glatt, Phil D'Amato, you
guys are starting to see that Kentucky is just too hard to pass up. The biggest problem with Kentucky is obviously getting stalls there.
Yes.
A lot of races, a lot of horses now, not a lot of stall space. So that's a little bit of a tricky part. We just thought with the inception of the, you know, racing machines, casino-type
right.
things, whatever.
HR, what do they call those?
Proper term.
Historic horse racing.
Historic racing, whatever the proper terminology is. That
slot machines.
It would be better to get a foothold there sooner rather than later. So it's been a couple of years. We've got a great crew there. Justin Curran, who I used to work with at Todd Pletcher's, runs the operation there. And we have certainly a long history. He used to gallop Rags to Riches, Scat Daddy, and some horses like that. So he's well aware of how we go about things and what
Good.
We like. So it's been a great addition.
Before I come back to Turfway and the weekend, because I do want to ask you about Yellow Card, but you mentioned Rags to Riches, and here's a question from John in Monrovia, meaning John White. He's asking for some Rags to Riches reminiscence, and of course, She's going to try again this year to get over the hump as a Hall of Famer. And I'll ask you that loaded question as well after you
We had out. A great 4 or 5 months out here with her in California. We were stabled at Hollywood Park. Hollywood Park had the synthetic in at the time, so it was a synthetic racetrack at Hollywood Park and a dirt racetrack at Santa Anita. So we were training at Hollywood Park.
On the cushion track at the time.
Whatever they called it at the time, yes. But she really was average at best on a regular basis, working on that surface. Just never seemed to kind of get over it very well. It didn't seem like she had a real kind of any kind of turn of foot or anything like that.
I didn't realize that.
But when we brought her over here, she was just, she was otherworldly, you know? I mean, she decimated competition.
I mean, I'll tell you, I mean, I sit up there with Gary at mornings, and I look at, I'm not great at watching horses go by. I can tell you, oh, that one looks good, that one doesn't. But I remember when she broke her maiden, it was at 7/8 here, that was one of those ones I went, oh, geez, look at that. Mm-hmm. You could tell, I mean, if I can tell, if I can say, wow, that looks great. And, you know, there's a history of horses that break their maiden at 7/8 that go on and do good
things. Absolutely.
And then she stayed here, of course, and won the Las Verges and the Oaks and then went on to, you know, do
Kentucky
her thing.
Oaks
and the Belmont.
What was it, what had happened between her debut at Churchill in June of 06 that then kept her out of training for how many months?
She had had a small setback. I don't think it was anything major. I do remember, though, just days before her first start, there were several riders that were going out of town, either to Arlington or to New York, or riders leaving, you know, at the end of the meet at Churchill to go. At that time, Arlington was big. Guys were going to Arlington. Some riders were going to Saratoga, what have you. But it was the end of the meet at Churchill. Not a whole lot of selection left. So she was actually ridden first time out by Brice Blanc. Her last work before she was to run was from the gate. She did not get away from there well, but I thought it was well enough for her to go ahead and run. And Todd had mentioned, should we maybe wait and work her again? And I thought, she'll be fine. We'll take her back there. And 72 hours, or I'm sorry, probably 6 days later, race day, Brice Blanc, gates open. She's nowhere to be found. And I believe she ran fourth that day.
She did.
Wasn't a real good phone call afterwards. You know, we had been certainly bragging on her and how good she was that summer. And for her to kind of, I don't want to say she laid an egg, but she just didn't bring her A game. Memorable phone conversation. I remember that. Yeah. she made up for it. As I said, she had an incredible 4 or 5 months here on the West Coast before she went back and did her thing in the Kentucky Oaks. And the Belmont still gives me goosebumps thinking about it. All those races, just to be a part of a career like that, just I look back on it with great fondness.
Do you know who was in that race?
Which race?
Her Churchill debut when she was four.
I think there's 3 or 4 stakes winners in there.
There sure are. There was the Klein's change-up for
Very
Steve
fast,
Flint.
Very fast filly. Yes.
She won. She went on to win the Pocahontas that year. And actually the dam of pinch hit. High heels. Anita Ebert's for Red Dog, for Gary Hartledge with Joe Johnson, was third in that race, and others. They're pretty funny key race to get started.
Funny how.
Yeah, it's always fun when you go back and you see that. And, you know, then she breaks the maiden with Garrett at in that 7/8 race you're talking about. And you, Michael, you've got correct. What stake? What? There's several of her races, right, that you had your name on.
Race or two out here in California.
Right?
Maybe, I think it was the Las Virginis, yeah. The Las Virginis, I believe.
Okay.
Maybe the Las Virginis and Santa Anita Oaks, but.
Yeah, because I remember.
That she won here?
No, that his name is on a couple of her stake wins. And during, I think that was, I don't know if that was, that might have been in the wake of Wait a While. Right? I think.
Yes, I'd say that's, I believe that's.
The Associated.
Actually, no, that's not correct.
No?
I can't remember what it was.
It was something.
Yeah, but
it was,
anyways.
Anyway, you.
As long
you,
as she gets in the Hall of Fame, that's all that matters.
There's the bottom line. Let's. This yellow card that broke the maiden on Saturday, too, at Turfway. This is for Jim and Donna Danielle. A lost treasure colt.
Nice horse. Thought he ran sneaky good his first time out, sprinting on the synthetic at Turfway. Made the lead for a brief moment. Did not switch leads and end up kind of finishing a decent third, a tiring third. Came back and trained very, very well. I kind of had my sights set on maybe running him a mile in his second start, and we just decided to go ahead and shorten him up. His pedigree seemed like he'd be better around one turn. Than the two. I'm glad we went ahead and did so. I thought his race the other day was very, very good. Bounced out of there, took pressure in, you know, from the outside, being drawn down inside, ran away from there late. So nice to have options with a horse like that. Obviously, turf races at Turfway Park or at Keeneland are 5/8 or 5.5. And so maybe we'll go ahead and try him back on the dirt. His works on the dirt have been decent, so we'll see. We've got some options there.
Well, you're going to have another filly you're going to run on Derby Day as well, correct?
Sweet Azteca. It's kind of,
yeah.
We've got the soft circle around. Well, I shouldn't say a soft circle, a hard circle around the Derby City Distaff. So she'll work here in the next day or two. She's doing very well. Her first out performance there at Churchill, where I think she went the opening quarter like in 20-4.
But you don't see too many of those
there. No, you don't. So looking forward to getting her back there. Just with all these horses, when you know they're that good, you just really concentrate on keeping them healthy, and they take care of the rest for you.
Tell me about this first out turf sprint winner, We're in Trouble.
Very good race here the other day. Had been ready weeks ago. Raced, just didn't fill, so we had to kind of keep on after him here for a couple of weeks. And had been touting himself in the morning. Again, another horse whose works were probably average at best on the dirt, but being by, I think, World of Trouble, I think he's, you know, got a right to move up on the grass, and he certainly did. I thought that was a very good performance the other day.
Chad Schumer picked out for, tell me about Colbert Stables, and well, Richard Colvin, I see his name with several partners.
These guys have a few horses with us. Best of them being Lord Bullington, who won the Qatar Mile here, Breeders' Cup Week. You know, they've put some money into the game here the last 2 years. Have been buying two-year-olds, have been buying, you know. I don't think we've bought a yearling yet, but hopefully things keep on going the right way and we start buying some yearlings and stuff. But guys are all passionate about the game. It's four childhood friends, high school friends, lifelong friends. And then Dick Colvin, longtime owner, owned horses into the 60s and things like that. He's won a couple hundred races. So these guys are all passionate about the game, live on the west side, love coming to Santa Anita. Obviously had a lot of success out here in California. So we're just trying to build on that.
$65,000 purchase, OBS April.
Needed a little time after the sale to kind of get himself squared away, but he's grown up and he's filled out and he's a beautiful horse. So
nice.
We're thinking good things with him here later in the year, hopefully.
Well, you mentioned Sweet Azteca coming out of the Beholder win, the grade one. What about Three Witches?
Three Witches was on schedule for the Madison, missed a few days with a little bit of a temperature last week. So we're still sort of on the fence there. She's back training. She'll probably work here over the weekend, and we'll make our decision or make our mind up from there. But obviously, if we don't go to something like the Madison, we'll go ahead and wheel her into the Derby City Distaff as well.
Very nice. And you know, one thing that's notable as you go through, you know, some of these nice performances and performers, you've really got a nice array of owners.
It's nice to be supported like that. you know, out here in California, it's, I think it's so vital that we thrive out here, and to see, you know, getting some support from a lot of East Coast outfits, like a lot of East Coast owners, it's a feather in our cap, and it just goes to show you how important California racing really is.
Mike Rapoli.
Just sent you, right? Yeah, half
Mike,
a dozen?
Mike has always, you know, he's been great with me. He's been great with basically everybody he's involved with. So, you know, it's nice to go ahead and be supportive with someone who has the numbers that he has.
And, yeah. And of course, the association with Eclipse.
Obviously, Aaron was put me in business to start. And, you know, that's... obviously, I guess I could tell you he's our longest supporter, but he's also a close friend. He's a family friend. It's one of those relationships. I feel like I started with them, and we'll end with them.
And of course, Aaron Wellman we're talking about, and Eclipse has been around 10-12 years.
They started. I think they're about 12 years. 12.
Something
this is probably
like that.
Going on close to.
And
12, 13
I remember
years,
the
like that.
You know the beginnings of it, the little talk, and this we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and they have quietly amassed a wide array of horses. They run all over. They have multiple trainers, and you know Aaron knows the business because of his lineage, and does a great job. He's a good businessman, and he hires the right people to take care of business, and. I can't, you know, you look down every once in a while and you see, oh, Eclipse. So they've quietly made their mark.
Certainly. I mean, he's second generation. His parents were obviously owners and breeders here in the state of California. He's never been shy about mentioning his association and his family's association with Bill Shoemaker and, you know, somewhat of a mentor to him. And he's had, you know, countless stakes winners, grade one winners. And now worldwide, I think he's won he's won in Australian Oaks. They've won
pretty wild,
races at Ascot. And on racing's biggest days, he's been there. You know, I mean, he's Belmont winner with Taprit and so many other good horses. You know, Nest last year. So the list goes on and on, whether in whole or partnership. But we enjoy our association. It would be that'd be an understatement. But yeah,
and you know. He's a big supporter of California racing. Of course, he's got enough horses to spread out. But, you know, it's appreciated that he hasn't forgot where he comes from and does run a lot of his horses here.
Exactly. I mean, I think you just sit around and look across this racetrack here. You don't get to see, you know, an atmosphere, a backdrop like this, you know, every day. I mean,
do get to see it every day.
Unfortunately, you're right. So I take that back. But I mean, to be able to train here underneath the San Gabriel Mountains, perfect climate, perfect weather. I don't think there's anywhere better to train a horse than the winter out here in California. Our racetrack is fantastic. That's, you know, a lot of changes have been made, some for the better, some are
maybe
still
not
a work in progress, I guess,
but no,
there's nowhere I'd rather be.
On that topic, if you don't mind riffing, and I mentioned the toe hold that you, and more than a toe hold, because you're running, you ran how many horses at, I'm just going to, here, you had 27, going into the weekend, you had 27 starts over the winter at Turfway as their meet winds down, and obviously, you know, your position for Keeneland starting and Churchill. What's your view of the tumult that came to a head last week in terms of, you know, the saber rattling about, you know, selling the racetrack and, you know, the circumstances, the North versus being pitted versus the South?
I think that's incredibly unfortunate. It doesn't sound like one survives without the other, really. I don't know all the machinations of how this place operates. Obviously, handle is paramount. I think there are some things going on here at Santa Anita with some purses being overpaid and things like that. Obviously, we've got to go ahead and get this lined out. You don't know how long you can operate, you know. in the Red Four, if that's even correct. I don't know. I could be speaking out of turn. But it's unfortunate that something like Northern California would have to go away for us to be a viable product down here. You know, there's still 1,000 horses up there, several hundred people involved on a daily basis. So unfortunate to say the least. You read a little bit, it's hard not to read, but I try not to put too much into it. I try to rather concentrate on what I've got going on at Barn 59. But it certainly makes you think, you know. We're spoiled out here. We make one move a year, and the one move we make happens to be even prettier than the place that we're at now, which is hard to think. But it's nice making one move to Del Mar, one move back, and having a viable racing product here, you know, 9 months out of the year, 8 months out of the year with small stints at back at Del Mar and then Los Alamitos for however long Los Alamitos may last for. So I'm sure there's a lot to be worked out. Hopefully there's a viable solution to all of this. I don't have it.
You know, and basically almost echo what Michael said, but this needs to be worked out. We need some stability here, however, whatever that means. Before you can go out and try and ask people to come here and race.
You know, back in the late 50s, 60s, 70s, even obviously into the 80s, it was customary for West Coast or for East Coast outfits to come and winter out here, or Camden, South Carolina, or Aiken, South Carolina, or obviously Florida. Sure. But, you know, Laz Barrera, Pancho Martin, Scotty Schulhofer, I remember when I first started coming around the racetrack and had horses here. You know, big time outfits came out here for the winter with big horses for you know, big breeders. You don't see a whole lot of that anymore. You know, Kentucky outfits are more and more starting to stay in Kentucky because the purse increases.
Well, they're afraid to lose their foothold.
Exactly. New York outfits, the majority of them go to Florida. You'll see one or two of them maybe go to New Orleans for, you know, or maybe send a handful of horses to Oakland or what have you. But this ties in back to obviously the Tex Sutton thing as well. You don't see the
movement
like you used to.
Right.
So I believe that's, like I said, that's hurt us here on some big days as well. But day in and day out, you open up, you see 5 and 6 horse fields. From a betting standpoint, that makes things difficult. Obviously, the purses here are not quite as attractive as they are in other places. So some things to be worked out. Hopefully there's a solution at the end of the day, and we thrive and stay a viable product out here.
Well, and it was, you know, it was certainly when you started your career and we talked, you know, right at the origin when you set up shop, you know, you wanted to be here, native, and it was, you know, your first choice. And having, I mean, I won't say it's mid-career yet, but let's call it the first third of your career. I mean, to have to make these kinds of decisions potentially, I had this discussion with Mark Glatt in the last 18 months as well, having to confront a potential upheaval for family and business.
It's something it's always in the back of your mind. I was fortunate enough. I spent nearly 6 years in Kentucky working for Todd Pletcher. I had a fantastic schedule. Keeneland through Thanksgiving in Kentucky. Thanksgiving through, you know, the spring, the full winter season out here in California. Certainly enjoyed my time in Kentucky, enjoyed being there. One thing people don't realize about being in Kentucky is you spend a lot of time on the road. Whether you live in Lexington, whether you live in Louisville, or wherever it may be, you're 4 weeks at Keeneland, 6 weeks at Churchill, 2 months at Ellis, 2 weeks at Kentucky Downs, back to Churchill, back to Keeneland,
up the turfway.
Back to Turfway. Yeah. So there's a lot of moving. And, you know, the one thing is if you're fortunate enough and you're thriving and you'd hope that you are, you have the option to get yourself to Florida for the winter.
You can stay one place for
get yourself to Florida for the winter, or the fairgrounds, Oaklawn Park or what have you. So it's not like you move, you stay there. You're hoping that you're thriving, you're doing well enough to be able to go to one of those places. But it's not easy. Like I said, you're on the road, and these racetracks aren't necessarily close to each other. It's 55, 60 minutes from Keeneland to Churchill and vice versa. Ellis Park, you know, if you're living in Lexington, I think that's a pretty good haul to Ellis Park for the summer, not to mention it's pretty toasty out that way. So you've got weather the elements like that, but we're spoiled out here, you know.
Yeah.
That's part of the reason I like being here.
I think you'll see that everyone you see here and everyone out there, they're here because they want to be here.
Exactly.
Right?
No,
nobody wants this to,
my
to,
experience
to not be around.
Is that it's a lot easier to come east to west than it is to come west to east. You're spoiled out here right off the bat, and I think anyone that spends any amount of time out here will tell you the same.
Yeah. So,
Michael,
we'll get it straightened out.
I want to ask you about one more horse, and I'm curious where you stand with Formidable Man.
He will run on Friday here, mile and an eighth allowance race. You know, I think he's got a great chance here on Friday. He was a very good second the other day. I think he'll find himself on or close to the lead, and I don't think the mile and an eighth is going to be an issue for him.
This for the Warrens.
Son of Sydney Light for Mr. and Mrs. Warren.
Mr. and Mrs. Warren.
Out of Fantacola.
Fantacola applied her trade out here in California.
Yeah.
I believe she was trained by Phil D'Amato.
Phil D'Amato, sure. Stakes man.
Mr. Warren, I've never met Mr. Warren, but he was big in Oklahoma.
Tulsa.
I went to the Bruce Springsteen concert, and I met a guy, and I said I was in the horse business, and then he goes, "Do you know Mr. Warren?" I said, "Absolutely," and it was right after you had the
won the Pegasus,
pleasure,
yeah.
won, had the pleasure to go play at Augusta,
yeah.
And you had mentioned that he was a member, right? Yeah. And so when the guy was talking to the guy, and he was didn't quite know if I was real or not, and I go, "Yeah, Mr. Warren, he's a member at Augusta, I believe." And he went, "Oh, yeah." And he walked me right up front into the pit at the Springsteen show. Yes. So I love
you.
Mr. Warren. It was perfect.
Yeah, he's
household
name in Tulsa.
Absolutely. Which I didn't realize. And this gentleman who I just met, it started telling me stories about it's big in town and, you know, very philanthropic, mm-hmm. and the whole city and
very,
everything. So
yeah,
I picked the right name to say yes to. It was great.
Wonderful family.
And of course, being a city of light, right, was...
It's an easy sell. Easy sell.
Yeah, and, yeah. And it's, I tell you, you know, it's funny. You think about... He's had a number of trainers. And in fact, for those that were following me at Fairgrounds this weekend, Dennis of Cork, Davey Carroll. And of course, after Sunday... Son Declan, his last ride, is going to start doing some bloodstock work under the wing of David and Gordo, and Davey and Kim going to work for Cherie DeVoe. And but Dennis of Cork, I was around the Carroll Barn that whole Derby run, ended up third. I got a horseshoe. Dennis of Cork was being shod leading up the Derby.
And, Warren's had several good horses.
Right?
St. Liam.
Yeah. St. Liam.
Charitable Man.
Yeah. Lieutenant. The Lieutenant. The poor Lieutenant.
Unfortunately, the
that
poor
was
Lieutenant.
Obscene.
City of Light. So, yeah, that's. We're trying to find one for him. We're trying to get him to the Promised Land one more time.
Wow.
We'd like to get him there twice more. But, you know, he's obviously been an incredible supporter. He is. Just been a blessing for myself and my family. So very thankful for that relationship. Very, very thankful.
Well,
it means a lot to me.
I'm sure he's thankful on the other end, too.
Well, Michael W. McCarthy.
Some small way.
You're You're rolling.
Thank you, guys.
Going to be a big, spring.
Hope you're right.
I was looking forward to this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Michael W. McCarthy.